There they all hung, the midday mealtimes and the illnesses, and the breath exhaled and the smoke of years, and the sweat from armpits that makes clothing heavy, and the flat reek of mouths, and the clammy odor of perspiring feet.
Hello, this is Art Fictions. I'm artist Gillian Knipe, and from me, it's a big warm welcome to this special culture exchange series in conjunction with the British Council's International Season. Guests for the series are artistic practitioners whose practice is underpinned by shifts, upheavals, or the need to reassess and redefine their cultural identity. First up, let's meet Russian-born, London-based sculptor Nika Nilova, whose work and selected novel by Rainer Maria Rilke play on the embodiment of our surrounds and the way our surrounding objects and architecture carry traces of us. Nika reads a brief excerpt in the beginning from a writer who describes husks of men, moist with the spittle of fate, dribbling slowly down the street, leaving a dark, dirty trail behind them. And a woman whose bleary eyes looked as if someone with a disease had spat green phlegm under her bloody eyelids. Of course, Nika finds some more tender phrases as we journey towards her studio practice of repurposed materials which carry memory and find new ways of being in the world in their reconfigured forms.
Architectural places, they always come back to you as fragmented, as something that you recollect but not entirely, and something that is like a huge puzzle that never makes sense.
Nika Nilova, welcome to Art Fictions.
Thank you, Gillian. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
You've chosen the notebooks of Malte Lauritz-Brigg, a name which neither of us really know how to pronounce, so we're just going to bumble through it. It was written in 1910 by Rainer Maria Rilke. So you've really challenged me. Luckily, I relish a challenge. I mean, you tell me what you think. It's about death, 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 and that love is no redemption for death.
I think it is a meditation on death, definitely, yeah. And death and life can coexist in one instant. And there are beautiful passages where he talks about pre-industrial times, people carrying their deaths inside of them, like stones in the fruit, and then comparing it to Paris, where he lived in the beginning of the century, where he observed a hospital that delivered mass-produced deaths. And I kind of find it very beautiful, the description of life through the prism of death.
Yes, that's a really nice way to put it. Weirdly, there's not much about life, living life. Anyway, let's move on. So on the simplest level, we are audience to the inner workings of Malte Lauritz-Brigg's mind. It's rightfully referred to as a notebook rather than a diary, as it seems like a fragmented stream of consciousness. And I actually thought of it as an artist's notebook. And I don't know if you keep a notebook. I certainly do. But one entry doesn't really connect with the next entry or the previous entry. And you get all sorts of first, second and third persons mixed up. And the context continually changes without explanation or anticipation. So, for example, in one instance, he spends over six pages talking about death, beginning with his father's death. And then in the next paragraph, he swiftly changes to reflecting on one's neighbours. Did you just read it or listen to the audiobook?
I read it multiple times because it's like it's a narrative that you can kind of drift in and out of. Yeah, I reread it last night before the podcast. Fresh again in my mind.
I also listened to it on audiobook, and I found that I'd be listening to it thinking, hang on, I didn't read that. And then I would have to go back to the book because it's so dense. And in fact, I read a review at some point where somebody said, you can't just read it like a book. Mm-hmm. You need to go in and out of it in the same way he goes in and out of it, in the same way you would go in and out of your artist's notebook. Anyway, it points towards an autobiographical collection of ideas, considering that the main character, Brigg, is the same age as Rilke when he wrote it. Brigg is a poet who questions, who is he to consider himself qualified to write? And yet write he must, as something must be done. And by the way, I think this feels extremely close to an artist's questioning of their rightfulness to make work, as well as their urgent drive to do so. And especially, I think, in this age of climate disaster, you know, putting more things in the world feels like almost the wrong thing to do. and yet the urgent drive to create work exists. And hopefully we can get into a little bit of that, because I know you do a lot of repurposing of materials. Despite its splintered approach, there is a certain orchestration within the text where ideas build to become more intense, metaphors multiply, the worst becomes repellent, while love heats up to an engulfing fire. And I got a sense this was like there was something almost musical in the way things became more and more intense. And there were also recurrent themes that give the so-called novel a sense of balance. And these include writing itself, existence, objects, emotions, time, God, death, 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 love. And love being no solution, as he himself is in love with his aunt. He's a religious poet, deeply imbued with a sense of the sacred in terms of both its presence and its loss. In fact, Rilke is considered a transitional figure between tradition and modernist writers, and a large part of that is a shift into an age of disbelief, of solitude and anxiety. In other words, this is an excellent post-lockdown book, speaking of solitude and anxiety. And he's also writing it at the time of the beginnings of psychology, and also in Germany, the beginnings of psychoanalysis. I was also very aware of Jean-Paul Sartre's Nausea, which I discussed with Emma Cousin, and this seems to preempt Nausea, where Sartre's Roquetan suffers from man's inherent existential condition that everyone experiences but may not be consciously aware of. Nika, I don't want to hear me talk anymore. Can you talk to me about your impressions of the book? Well, I guess, first of all, this wasn't your first choice book.
I've actually really enjoyed your analysis of the book, and I would like to hear more about it. It was very difficult for me to choose a book, in fact, because I had many, many options, and this was one of them, but it's not very evident as a choice, because to me it is more a poem rather than a novel. But I did have a few other contenders that I wanted to discuss, and two of them in particular were The Years by Annie Ernaux, which reads in a very similar fashion, and the other one is The Remainder by Tom McCarthy.
Wow. So,
which has just been discussed on a previous podcast with Holly Hendry.
Holly got in there first.
Absolutely. But this book is something that I still very much enjoy. It's one that I read first in 2010, exactly 100 years since it was published in 1910. And I do like to think about cyclicality of history and specific spans of time and how certain things come back. And when everything changes, certain things do stay the same. And then I reread this book again last year during lockdown, which was 10 years later in 2020. And so there was another cycle of my history added on top of the first reading. So these are some things that I address a lot in my work, and I enjoy doing it as well through reading, kind of unearthing various time repetitions. The other reason why I chose this book is because Rilke could be considered as a truly European poet. He had many national heritages, histories and literatures, customs, languages that occupied his nature. So he spent a lot of time in France, Italy, Scandinavia, Germany, Russia in particular. And so this book becomes a kind of matrix of references that does not inhabit one nation, but borrows from multiple cultures. And this is something that I find really relevant to myself, having lived as well in multiple places. And the other reason is what you have mentioned, is this kind of fragmented, slippery narrative. It kind of captures a multiplicity of histories that are both real and imagined. And in a sense, the novel is a modernist novel because it is so fragmented, and it combines these observations and memories and childhood recollections, ghost stories, with historical interpretations. And it kind of drifts in and out of focus, and there is no specific beginning and no ending. And there is the idea of perseverance past the end. So you mentioned death, 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 but there is no finality in the death that he describes. There is always a continuity past the end. And furthermore, for me, what is very interesting is that it's non-linear, it's not chronological. So the impressions and notes, they do not follow any chronological order, allowing the kind of simultaneous existence of the past, present, and future. And this simultaneity of timelines, I think, is quite extraordinary because you kind of time travel and you drift from paragraph to paragraph. You end up in different places, in different cultures, and in different times. And I think this kind of nonlinear progression draws very interesting arcs between historical interpretations and some imagined events or childhood recollections, which addresses the nature of our perception of life. The leaping between timelines is something that I try to do a lot in my practice, and that's why I find it very appealing to see how it is addressed through text. It's semi-autobiographical, so the protagonist is partly Malte Lorenz-Brügge, partly Rilke, partly someone else. And again, he drifts in and out of focus, but he's learning to see things when he comes to Paris. But he is seeing the things we live among and discusses human things through non-human entities. From a sculptor's perspective, it's very interesting to see how often he discusses how objects imprint themselves on people, almost from the object's perspective. There are beautiful passages when he talks about the house dispersed within me, for instance, or the street lamp that knew a great deal about me. And I think this kind of turn is something that is particularly interesting addressed in poetry because it has this very vivid language.
Actually, that reminds me of the collector.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes.
The other reference to objects that I thought was fantastic was with regards to the lid of a tin. He's talking about this idea that the lid ought to have no other desire than to be on its tin. Humankind, if we may very briefly compare them with these lids, fit on to their occupations most reluctantly and with a bad grace. Things have, by now, been observing this for centuries. No wonder they are corrupted if they lose the taste for their natural silent functions and want to take advantage of existence, just as they see it everywhere being taken advantage of. Which is brilliant, because it's like humans are such a bad example for the objects that they possess.
Yes, there is quite a post-anthropocentric take, actually, on a lot of the descriptions, which yeah. I find really fascinating.
Yeah. Sorry, I did interrupt you. Was there anything else that you wanted to say at this point?
Yeah, the last thing why it made an interesting read during lockdown is the kind of hypersensitivity of the language and the hypersensitivity of the narrative. It's kind of under the skin. Everything is turned inside out and everything is felt and perceived to an extreme degree. And there is this anxiety, this kind of panic spasming through the book, and a fundamental crisis in which we all find ourselves, whether it's 100 years ago or today. And I think the poetic language of Rilke gives a really interesting insight into this hypersensitive anxiety.
Mm. Let's come back to the learning to see. So I thought that was really interesting in terms of his age. And so in order to write a single line of poetry, you know, one must see many great cities, people and things, have an understanding of animals, sense how it is to be a bird in flight, and know the manner in which little flowers open every morning. One needs to have love and lost and all those sorts of things. And one should wait and gather meaning and sweetness a whole life long, a long life if possible, and then at the very end, one might perhaps be able to write 10 good lines. So he is saying, you know, you can't possibly create art, essentially, mm-hmm. until you've lived a life. But then your life is over and mm-hmm. you will not have created any art.
Yeah, that description stayed with me both times, as it is quite poignant and it is relevant to how one thinks of their practice, how I think of my practice. I suppose what I find very interesting is how he discusses the lifespan. And to me, when I read that, there's the juxtaposition of the lifespan of a person versus the span of a whole generation. And then there is the lifespan of a person versus the duration of artifacts. And everything occupies time somewhat differently. I like how he embeds his timeline in the timeline of an entire generation. So the way I read it is he sort of adopts the previous generations and takes them on board, and that way extends the lifespan in which he exists. I think it's also interesting the kind of the silences and the intervals in between, and like the way of sleeping through time, through these various observations, and how they negate each other in a way, because in describing this, it's also an exercise in writing.
Can you explain that a little bit further?
The way that he says you cannot write, and yet he is writing in order to practice writing.
Yes, of course, yeah.
There's the kind of cyclicality in everything. But I think it's the different durations of lifespans that to me are the most relevant in this case. Like, for instance, at the end of the first half, there is a long description of the tapestries lady with the unicorn, which brings the whole novel, which was very fluid and there is a lot of movement. And then suddenly you have almost perfect stasis of these artifacts that were created before and they exist now in his present tense. And we can still experience it today in our present tense. But again, there is a different duration.
So speaking of time, he does look at the development of knowledge over time by burrowing deeper and deeper into metaphysical preoccupations. And he exercises this in a number of ways throughout the book. And one of them is his ponderings that start with, is it possible? Do you want to pick up on that point?
Yes, I think one of the parts that I find interesting in the Is It Possible monologue is where he again talks about this extended timeline of existence by borrowing the time of his ancestors. And he says, is it possible that every single one of us had to be reminded that he came from all those who had gone before, and that knowing this, he would refuse to listen to others possessed of other knowledge? Yes, it is possible. I think it's very interesting how he plunges in this other timeline and kind of opens it up to exist in it with the same right as you exist in your own timeline.
In fact, in that passage of Is It Possibles, he covers so many things. We could just have a whole discussion. And in fact, we could probably do a whole series of discussions just on those passages. So, for instance, is it possible that people who say God and suppose they mean something shared by all? And then he concludes, but if all of this is possible, if there is even so much a glimmer of possibilities to it, then something must be done, for pity's sake. This young foreigner of no consequence, Brig, he will have to write. That's so brilliant. And it sort of links back to the ideas of Pascal. I am a nothing who thinks. Man is but a reed, the most feeble thing in nature, but he is a thinking reed. In a funny way, connects back to the remainder with Holly Hendry in the previous episode, because there is something of man being some sort of leftover detritus of evolution. Well, that's a way I thought of the book. Are there any other passages that you wanted to read out?
Yes, there are actually two passages which I found the most interesting, and those are the ones that address this juxtaposition of human life versus the life of buildings, of architecture and of objects. And that's something that relates most closely to my practice.
I think I know what you're going to read out. Okay, yeah.
And one of them is something that I've referred to before, where he writes about his ancestral house. I never saw that remarkable house again, for it passed into the possession of strangers after my grandfather's death. In the memories I have of it, shaped as they were by a child's understanding, it is not a building. To my mind, it consists of discrete parts. Here a room, there a room, and here a stretch of passageway that does not connect these two rooms, but is preserved in isolation as a fragment. In this way, it is all dispersed within me, the rooms, the staircases that descended with such elaborate ceremony, and other tight, spiral stairs where one passed through the dark as the blood passes through the veins. The rooms in the towers, the balconies hung on high, the unexpected galleries onto which one was thrust by a little door. All of these things are still within me, and will never cease to be in me. It is as though the image of this house had fallen into me from a measureless height and shattered on the bottommost part of myself. So I'm quite interested in this description, as it describes an entire childhood through architecture and how your memories and childhood recollections imprint themselves deeply. Also, when I think about making work and architectural places, they always come back to you as fragmented, as something that you recollect but not entirely, and something that is like a huge puzzle that never makes sense. This description is very beautiful in a sense that it's completely shattered, but it's also deeply personal. And there is this very interesting connection between the architecture of the building and the biology of the body, where he talks about blood passing through the veins. And I think this kind of connotations and arcs drawn between the insides of the body, the insides of building, insides of memories, something very interesting to kind of drift in and out from these three distinct lines of thought. And there is a second passage, which is very...
So just before you move on, I mean, I thought that was such a brilliant passage, and I'd also highlighted it, and I did laugh at his mention of spiral stairs, because one of the things that we will talk about in your practice is the stair banisters that you repurpose. That passage also helped to explain the book and the way the book was structured, where you get this sort of fragmentation because you have these experiences in the hallway, which is separate from this room and that room. And that is how we experience life. And the book is how our minds work. You know, we do dart throughout all these different subjects and times at any one moment. And somehow most of us are quite contained. And when you see it in writing, you think, oh my God, it's all over the place. But he's not really as all over the place as what it initially seems. You had another passage.
Yes, this passage was famously quoted by Heidegger in his book, The Basic Problems of Phenomenology. And it's a rather long passage. But it's a very beautiful passage that again addresses this idea of architecture absorbing the human entities and where humanity becomes a vestigial memory. And I think it's very interesting, again, to see how objects outlive the inhabitants, their owners, the people they interacted with. So here's the passage. Will anyone believe that there are buildings such as these? Rather, to be exact, there were buildings that were no longer there. Buildings that had been torn down, top to bottom. What remained was the building that had stood next to them, the tall neighboring structures. Evidently, they were in danger of collapsing, now that nothing was left beside them. A complex scaffolding of long, tarred poles had been driven in at an angle between the rubble-covered waste ground and the exposed wall. I do not know if I have already said that. It is that wall that is in my thoughts. It was not, as it were, the first wall of the existing building, as one would have supposed, but the last one of those that were no longer there. You could see the inner side. You could see the walls of rooms of the various floors, with wallpaper still adhering, and here and there a fragment of the floor or ceiling. Next to the walls of the rooms, a dirty white space ran down the entire wall, and through it, describing an inexpressibly disgusting, worm-like twist, like that of the digestive tract, crept the wide-open, rust-speckled channel of the toilet plumbing. The course of the gas pipes for the lighting was visible in grey dusty traces along the edge of the ceiling, and in places they had unexpectedly doubled round and run down the colourful walls and into some black hole that had been gashed uncaringly. Most unforgettable of all, though, were the walls themselves. The stubborn life of those rooms had refused to be stamped out. It was still there. It clung to the nails that were left. It stood on the remaining hand's breadths of floors. It had crept under the corner joists where there was still a little of the interior. You could see it was in the paint, which it had gradually changed from year to year, blue into moldy green, green into grey, and grey into an old, stale, putrescent white. But it was also in the fresher spots that had survived behind mirrors, pictures, and wardrobes, for it had traced the outlines of these things over and over. It was in every flayed strip. It was in the damp blisters and the lower edges of the wallpaper. It flapped in the torn-off shreds, and it sweated out of nasty stains made long ago. And from these walls that had once been blue, green, or yellow, there issued the air of those lives, a stale, idle, foggy air not yet dispersed by any breeze. There they all hung, the midday mealtimes and the illnesses, and the breath exhaled and the smoke of years, and the sweat from armpits that makes clothing heavy, and the flat reek of mouths, and the clammy odor of perspiring feet. There they hung,
the acrid tang of urine and the smell of burning soot and the steamy greyness of potatoes and the sleek, heavy stink of old lard. The sweet lingering smell of neglected infants hung there, and still more had been wafted in by the weak, tame, domesticated breezes that always stay in the same street. And there was a lot more besides of unknown origin. I did say, did I not, that all the walls had been demolished but for the last? It is that last wall that I have been talking of all along. You might assume I stood looking at it for a long time, but I swear I broke into a run the moment I recognized that wall, for that is the terrible thing. I recognized it. I recognize everything here, and that is why it enters into me so readily. It is at home in me. So this rather long passage, again, I think to me it sums up most of the book and most of the other observations. I think, again, there is this interesting parallel between the biology of the body and the biology of the building, the kind of internal tracts of the building that are exposed and the memories they have absorbed. And there is this interesting, in my mind, parallel with The Remainder by Tom McCarthy, where he talks about all these breezes and things that are brought from below and from above, and the lingering smells of life, which is something that the protagonist and The Remainder is trying to reconstruct from fragments of memory. This is kind of the opposite side of it, as you imagine an entire life based on a scrap of wallpaper. And I think it has the inherent sense of loss, which travels through the entire book, as the lives that are gone, the architectures that are gone, the change in the centuries, the change of tradition into modernism, one life disappearing and the other one not yet fully begun.
I just thought it was extraordinary the way that he talks about the bodily internalization of one's surrounds, something that I am very, very interested in, and this sort of porousness that he has in general. I mean, for instance, on the sighting of a ghost, he says, "Beside me, the major gave a vigorous jerk that transferred into my body." And so all the time he recognizes himself as a very porous person, asserting therefore that all people are porous, whether they want to admit it or not. And so we are physically carrying our ancestors, as you said at the very beginning, carrying our debts with us and carrying the exchanges we have with other people as well, and the memories we have. I mean, he talks about memories where he says it's not really enough to have memories. You know, one has to be able to forget them and to have great patience to wait for their return, because it's not really the memories themselves that are of consequence. Only when they have become the very look within us, or our every look and gesture nameless and no longer distinguishable from our innermost self, only then in the rarest of hours can the first word of a poem arise in their midst and go out from amongst them. That made me very much think of your work process, where you acknowledge this internalization of our surrounds, and also the opposite of the human imprint on the object. But there is a necessary forgetting, you know, the way that we ingest our external world in some way, and then there's a paradoxical process internally, and then we recreate it in another way. But it's imbued with everything that's happened from that experience to now, and a conversation that we had on the way to the studio or whatever. Does any of that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's also that, like, as you say, processing these recollections and editing out. So you edit out parts of your own life and you draw a parallel to a historical event, or and you edit, like, it's almost like a montage of things that you've perceived, you've read, you've acknowledged, you've experienced, you've imagined, you've fictionalized, and then you kind of montage everything together, and then you edit out one excerpt that becomes it.
I did read something about the final third of the book being the most difficult, and actually in a way I found that the easiest, because I started researching different people. So he's talking about these two brothers and how one brother does the wrong thing by this other brother, blah blah blah, and then one of them accidentally kills his son, as you do. part of that comes from one story, part of that comes from another story. So I just let go of everything and just listened. I found that easier to listen to on the audiobook rather than to read, actually. And I felt I could just flow with that. The rest of the book felt like there were lots of edges throughout it. You know, stop, start, change, shift. Whereas this was like a movement a lot more. But often I didn't know who he was talking about. And I didn't feel that really mattered.
You never quite know when legend becomes a historical fact, when it becomes a ghost story. And I think it's fiction overlapping nonfiction is what I find the most interesting in this flow. Because you never know. And does it even matter what is real and what isn't?
Actually, a good example that demonstrates that is his referring to Ibsen, where he says, "So you remarked on that unprecedented act of violence, your work, which sought in the visible world ever more impatiently and ever more desperately for equivalence for what you had seen inside. Rabbit, glass, fire, sun, church, valley, towers, mountain ranges, avalanches that bury the countryside, covered a stage piled high with tangible things, that the intangible might be grasped as well." And so in that you get from rabbit to glass to an avalanche, and that way that he builds in his expression. And in another moment, he's talking about, you know, you breathe it in as part of something transparent. But within you, it precipitates, hardens, acquires angular geometric forms in among your organs. So he's often talking about this invisible world and the need to tangibilize, to make objects. That's certainly happening with your work and in the work of an artist.
I think it's very, very beautiful what you said before about the porousness of nature and how everything is absorbed by the person. And I think it's something extremely relevant in the sense how things are inhaled or swallowed or absorbed, and then they harden within you. And I think this is predominant in many descriptions, how it solidifies basically inside the body. Something intangible becomes solid, like a disease almost, that grows inside. And I think also it helps to see the entirety of the book as this continuous flow, like a flow of memory, is a flow of stories, a flow of ghosts that temporarily harden in their human vessels and then continues its flow further. So there is no specific beginning or end. It's a continuous flow. And then it materializes for a while in a human vessel, and then it goes on.
I really want to discuss so much more of this with you, but I'm going to move on to your practice. Rilke, you know, this cyclical process where you're continually repurposing objects. And I've been to your studio, and I must say it looks like a building site, including the rubble, which you then make into two-dimensional. Well, they're not really two-dimensional, they're slightly three-dimensional, but certainly wall pieces, which are exquisite. And it's strange because I think of your work as, you know, you're using natural materials, and you're actually not necessarily using natural materials at all. But it reminds me of an idea I read about some time ago. If we are organic creatures, if we can refer to ourselves as nature, then perhaps we can refer to the things that we make as nature. We can refer to the things that we make as organic. And I really get that sense with your work that, okay, you're not using natural materials. Natural materials have gone into some of the objects that you collect and then repurpose. But it does have this organic sense to it. And maybe it is that sort of cyclical reality that happens in repurposing. And I thought perhaps to demonstrate that, we might focus for a moment on your work that's currently in one of many fragments at the New Arts Centre. Do you want to introduce that work and maybe just describe it a little for people who are listening and not looking at it?
Okay, well, thank you for the beautiful description of my practice. Just to continue what you were saying about cyclical process and natural materials, I think you're very correct in saying that the materials, they don't end up being natural, there are things that have been processed and used, and there are artifacts that are taken out of human existence. But I try and borrow natural processes that happen in the earth, in geology, and this kind of continuous repurposing and reworking of things are similar to how the earth self-organizes itself, how energy is continuously converted. And so the works, to me, they end up being like work in progress constantly. It changes and repeats and comes back on itself, and there is no specific beginning or end in itself. And for me, really, it's not about fabrication per se. It's about finding modes to retrieve or reveal historical information or information from the past or from another timeline. But it's really about finding modes of retrieving things rather than making them or creating them out of nothing. And so the works that are currently on view at the New Art Center in the exhibition One of Many Fragments, they are called the Lemniscates. It's a series of work that I have begun some years ago. And each sculpture is made from banisters, from staircases, from demolished houses. And each sculpture consists of two flights of stairs, and I only keep the banister and I change the order of the pieces in such a way that the spiral that would have formed the staircase becomes a loop that closes in on itself, and it becomes this continuous strange architecture that just goes on going in cycles, and depending which angle you look at it, you see a different loop, but always there is the symbol of infinity present, which is like an imperfect eight in the case of these banisters. And there is a cyclicality of process there as well in the process of production, as all these banisters were produced over 100 years ago by craftsmen's hand and then spend another 100 years interacting with other hands in the houses where they served as handrails, guiding bodies through space, and then they were reworked by hand again to form these sculptures. That way, just underlining the cycle, but never finding a specific beginning or an end. It's again this continuous process. And so they become objects that are extended in time. And the interesting for me why I started the series is that the handrail was made specifically to fit in the palm of the hand. It's the form that is based on the proportion of the human hand. And so it's kind of a meeting point between the human body and the architecture of space. I also read that handrails, the surface of the handrails, kind of collects microscopic bits of skin and therefore contains DNA of hundreds of people who have interacted with them, kind of bringing this collective memory within them, which is very similar in a way to the passage I read out from the notebooks of architecture that has absorbed traces of its human inhabitants.
And also what you were saying before in terms of time stretching, with him referring to sort of whole generations as if they were all present. And I was thinking, I did go to New Arts Centre and looked at the work, and for wood, you know, for something solid, they look really watery and wobbly and bodily and limbs and rope and lassos and snakes even. And if you threw a circular rope on water, it would have that sort of movement that your sculptures make. But if I think of them as strange sort of warped circles around something, do you have a sense of what they might be enclosing?
A portal?
Yeah.
I think it's like an opening, a portal. To me, it's like everything is a bit of an access point elsewhere.
Mm.
And in this specific case, it's an access point to a past or a future or an alternative timeline where these objects evolve past their functionality and past their meaning and become something else. And the making of them is a bit like time travel for me, collecting something from the distant past, reworking them in the present, and kind of imagining a future iteration where they do not serve human needs, they don't serve architectural purposes, they become objects with their own agency. And I think this fluidity of form is very important to me. The title is Lemniscate, is a perfect eight mathematical symbol, but it's their imperfection that matters. It's how they break and how they kind of guide you into this three-dimensional or extra-dimensional space where you constantly kind of loop back and forth onto yourself. That's something that I like to imagine if you were to follow and be guided by it, like how you would move through space differently. Your body gets choreographed through space in a different way.
I find it interesting how when you talk and when I talk, we're both making these wavy movements with our arms, whether it's about the book or about your work. Yeah. And even that is a show of what the experience of the book and what the experience of your work is like. I want to come back to what you said about changing of meaning and time, because there's something that I find about the work where you have an unknown past. So, for instance, some banisters are particularly patterned from, I assume, the Victorian era, mm-hmm. as opposed to the Edwardian era. And the particular ways of carving are not necessarily understood, or the particular patterns, or the way that something may, you know, shift in its design. And so there's all this kind of unknown past and all this loss of meaning and new meanings that are imposed upon something. But then there's also ideas of the future as well. And it's almost like your work is preoccupied with the past and the future. And then the present becomes this big question mark, even as to whether, in a way, the present even exists, or if it's just some sort of odd overlap between the past and the future.
That's how I feel always about it. Okay. It's, I really struggle to be, I suppose, in the present moment. And that's why perhaps shifting timelines is something I feel most comfortable with, because there is this fictional future that I'm building and semi-fictional past that I'm unearthing. And the overlapping both of them, it's something that I have imagined in the present, but that moment gets taken out of the equation and it just transitions from that moment before to that moment after. We're like missing the stop in between. And I think that the way I approach making work, usually it has this idea of decoding and recoding existing structures. So it's not really about creating or putting something else into existence. It's really about taking something apart in one way or the other and then putting it back together and releasing an object that was already partly there before. So it's not entirely new. It's never in and of itself. It refers to something else that existed before. I think a lot of my practice is also about drawing arcs between ghost stories, recollections, historical moments, things that happened or never happened. It's always about bridging these different timelines, or trying to.
Yes, yes. And using the idea of bridging, I would like to move on to the focus of this series, which is cultural exchange. And like Rilke, you've had this experience of being born in one place but constantly traveling around. And I think, I don't know enough about the history of Europe, but you know, in one sense you could say that he was German, but Rilke was born in Prague in 1875. But he lived in a part of the world that was constantly changing its borders, especially Germany. Mm. And you were born in Russia, in Moscow, is that right?
Yes, I was born in Moscow.
Then tell me about where you have lived since then, up to now, when you were living in London.
It's interesting that you mentioned change in borders, because this is what defined the history of the eastern part of Europe for the past century, with the revolution happening and then the continuous changes in regime, the USSR, the collapse of the USSR, and right now the debates around the appropriation of Crimea, etc. So there is a continuous change of borders going on in that part of the world. So you never know where exactly you belong and what is the territory in question, and why it is so important to draw these borders. But not gonna go in there. I think, yeah, I was born in the USSR, as my passport says, the last year of the USSR, so when it all collapsed. And again, you were born in a country that doesn't exist anymore, which just transitions into being so many separate countries, which is strange.
That's so bizarre.
And then I moved around quite a lot in my childhood. I grew up in Paris, in France. I spent 6 years in Paris. So I went to French school, and at some point my first language was French, and Russian was kind of like a distant memory that I couldn't quite shake off. And then I went back to Russia and it became reversed. And then I left Russia when I was 15 for good. I lived in the Netherlands for 6 years, and then I moved to the UK, which was supposed to be just for my master's, and then it ended up being for a decade. Wow. Already.
And so has all that moving around made you a restless adult?
It has opened up a lot of things for me because of the continuous need to adapt to a new life and a new place, and a continuous need to adjust yourself to new circumstances, which in my case were very different because Russia in the 90s and France in the 90s were many worlds apart. So it's the continuous adjustment to circumstances that I think made me more versatile as a person. And there is a sense of fluidity, I think, that I'm very attracted to. The continuous movement, that nothing is static ever, that you never quite stop. It's a flow that temporarily settles, hardens, and then moves on as a flow. So I think this is how I see most of life. And I think that the sense of loss that I've mentioned before, that I was very attracted to in Rilke's book, is something that I find quite relevant in my life, because I lived so many lives that I have adopted and lost, because I grew up as a diplomatic child, and it's a very deceptive life because you're given a certain period of time to live a life, and then this life is taken away from you completely. So you have no roots, you have diplomatic immunity, so you never fully belong to a country, you are immune to the country you live in. But as a child, you adopt it, you become part of it, and then you're taken away from it, and you lose like an entire short life you've built. And so I think the sense of loss is what drove me through these moves. It was the constant separation that kind of fueled the desire to restart again and go through this cycle.
Can you tell me just a little bit more about how you managed that as a child? I guess in terms of directly influencing your art practice now, in the way that you obviously had to learn the language and go to different schools and meet new kids and form new friendships, but you also lived in new homes each time and needed to create a sense within yourself of home and security. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, that is correct, and that's why I think I quoted the first passage from the book about the house being dispersed in me, because there are these fragments of places that have imprinted themselves on me that I've remembered. And through moving a lot, I think I spent a lot of time with objects and with things, and attaching myself to places and to objects was easier than attaching myself to people. That was more of a transitory flow. And so I suppose I remember places through distinct, like, corners, architectural corners, staircases, rooms, fragments of places where I lived and inhabited. I cannot go back to any of these places. I don't have like a childhood home that I can go back to. So they're all kind of occupy my memory, which is why they're so fragmentary, and which is why I'm so interested in small fragments of architecture, like the view of a window sill or a step on the staircase that can kind of carry an entire life within them.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the idea of the architecture sort of holding you.
I think I've been influenced so much by places where I lived through just projecting my entire, I don't know, 5 years of my life onto one specific architectural memory that I have, that it becomes so loaded and potent with this entire like time of existence. And then to me, it carries so much more than being just a recollection. The interesting thing with the banister sculptures that we have discussed is that a lot of people, the first thing when they see the sculpture, they want to touch them, they want to see if the feeling of sliding one's hand on a wooden banister would bring up recollections from before. And a lot of people told me memories from childhood, from like sliding down banisters or like hiding on the stairs, like this touch between a hand and a wooden banister brings up so many things for people. And I think this is something I'm trying to find constantly by unearthing these little bits of places in my work.
I think that we can all relate to moments in life and in our earlier lives, especially when everything is so bewildering, how we might latch on to objects or parts of a room that can just sort of hold us together and contain us, because sometimes, yeah, life is just too leaky and uncontainable. And there's something, yeah, you know, obviously extremely sad about that.
Absolutely. And I think this is also something I've experienced a lot during lockdown, like trying to attach myself to a specific place or fragment of something to preserve some sanity.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you don't just work with the banisters. You've worked with lots of different materials and different objects. And one of them that I can particularly remember is the parquetry floors. But also, you work with a lot of things that look familiar, but then I don't quite know what they are. What's an example of that?
I think you're referring to the Dyson hand dryer.
Yeah.
That was cast in the studio. I think it's about unearthing objects that people can recognize but cannot quite place exactly.
Exactly.
And one of the first works that I did after graduating from the Slade was actually a piece where I cast bell clappers, and it's an extremely familiar object, yet nobody could quite understand where it belongs in the world.
What are they?
So the bell clapper is the inside of the bell, that moves and makes the noise.
Yeah.
And so it was a very interesting exercise in unearthing something that is slightly hidden from view and exposing it and see how people react to it, which is what I'm trying to repeat. So I cast a lot of things that are inside other things, or the reverse, or expose the back of the wall or what's under the floor. It's like a continuous turning things inside out and sort of revealing what's behind the pristine surfaces that we surround ourselves with.
Mm, absolutely. Do you have any other artists that are particularly potent for you?
It's a very interesting question. I've been thinking about it for a while, and I find it very difficult to, I think, extract one specific name, because to me it's not almost about individuals but more like a network of interconnected entities that are in correspondence with one another. And I think when you talk about influences or inspirations, like, it's very particular for particular moments in time, and then it constantly changes, mm-hmm. at least in my case. And so to answer that question, but if I had to answer this, I would say it's a long lineage of female sculptors, because I'm very fascinated by how they have transformed and altered and added to the discipline. And we could go on through the entire lineage with Louise Bourgeois or Barbara Hepworth or Eva Hesse, and how it changes and evolves through decades with adding new layers, like almost a dialogue that happens through time. And then you would switch on to like Anna Mendieta and Rachel Whiteread, Phyllida Barlow, mm-hmm. Eva Rothschild. Like, to me, I see it more like as a long line of points that connect to one another through time. I could say I'm always inspired and fascinated by medieval art, medieval philosophy, or pre-Renaissance, early Renaissance painting. If we were to go to Fra Angelico or Piero della Francesca,
yeah.
And just this transformation of space and pace and time. If I had to name one name that keeps coming back, it would probably be Andrei Tarkovsky, as I would always come back to his cinematic language, mm-hmm. and the fluidity of time and memory and recollections, and how a lot of it is brought through the images of flowing water, a water that flows through spaces, through cathedrals, through timelines. It kind of guides you through, again, bringing things together, past and present. A lot of his nostalgia is all about immigration and trying to reconcile Russia and Italy, the loss of Russia, appropriation of life in Italy, and the impossibility to bring the two together. So I think Tarkovsky is one that I could discuss at length as well, through his different films that have had a huge influence on me: the alienation, the otherness, the emphasis on objects rather than humans. Again, it's the objects, it's the settings, it's nature that carries the human emotion rather than the other way around. It's the environment that creates the specific perception, this anxiety of living the impossibility of reconciling the different experiences in one's life.
And I would also say Tarkovsky is full of ghosts.
Ghosts and witches and magic, and magic, as well, yeah, fiction, yeah, yeah. And time.
And tell me about books. What other books? You're an absolute reader.
I am an absolute reader. I actually made a list because I was afraid I would miss something.
We can put your list on the notes if you like, or you can read it.
I try and read very diverse literature, different timelines again. So I would go from Rilke and Romanticism to hydrofeminism in 1 week and just go back and forth. And I enjoy not belonging to one specific timeline. And so from what I've read recently in the past few months, The Volcano Lover by Susan Sontag, which again is set in the past, but draws beautiful parallels to the present through the act of collecting and performing, and all of this set against the volcano. Mount Vesuvius and the human time versus the time of the volcano. I could say Staying with the Trouble by Donna Haraway is a very beautiful book, and The Mushroom at the End of the World by Anna Tsing.
I feel like I'm the only person who hasn't read
it's
The Mushroom.
Fascinating. and then I would top it up by, let's say, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Wong, The Argonauts by Maggie Nelson.
And that featured on this podcast, actually, Jane Hayes Greenwood.
I absolutely love that book. And
it's gorgeous.
Man in the Holocene by Max Frisch.
I don't know that book. And I just find it interesting that you were talking before. You were talking in terms of a particular timeline, but you did say quite specifically, I enjoy not belonging. And that part of the sentence struck me. And do you feel that general sense, you know, from your experience of moving to all these different places, a sort of question mark over belonging and not belonging? I'm not even sure what that means. It's so all-encompassing.
That's very, very, very wide. It's difficult to answer because a lot of what we read is about trying to find attachment, to belong to something, and a lot of the mood of today in this country is to belong to a specific, like, very well outlined piece of land, piece of being in the world. But I think it's, for me, I enjoy not belonging, truly, partly because I probably can't, but also I wouldn't want to, as there is an attachment that comes with it and a kind of commitment that I'm not prepared to take. So I think being in different places and being in different times is first like an escape strategy or a coping strategy, but also a desire to be scattered and dispersed and to be part of many conversations at once rather than one.
I can completely relate to that, and it is very much in Rilke in terms of love. You know, he wants to love, but at the same time he can feel himself closing in on possessiveness. Mm-hmm. And I definitely have a sense of that myself with regards to, on the one hand, yearning to belong, but then if I really did belong, I would feel a sense of entrapment, which would
exactly
have me fleeing. So you've got one of many fragments, which is currently on at New Arts Centre. Where is it? Salisbury.
Yeah. And one thing I wanted to mention about this show in terms of cyclicality and history, it's a two-person show with Edward Allington.
That's right.
Who used to be the head of sculpture at the Slade School of Art when I did my MA there. Yeah. And so he was my tutor and the professor, the first person I met when I came to London for my interview. And so showing alongside his work 10 years later made like this interesting cycle come through once again, and it's a privilege to show alongside him, but also the fact that things do come back.
It's a bit odd to say, but it's such a beautiful coupling of works and the New Arts Centre. It is a really beautiful space in its own right, and it's a sort of bridging space in a way, isn't it? So your work is in the orangery, and then Edward Allington's work is in the passageway between the house and the orangery.
Mm-hmm. The gallery that was built
the gallery
to connect the house with the orangery.
And it's an exquisite architectural passage of time in its own right, because the orangerie was built
18th century.
Yeah, and then the gallery itself is very contemporary, and then you get in both of your works, I think of them as little corners of the world and little corners of architecture, obviously, that you are both highlighting in very, very different ways. I know it's in Salisbury, so for a lot of people that's quite a journey, but I will say, oh my gosh, the whole place is absolutely incredible. A beautiful art collection, sculpture gardens. It is a complete day of eye candy. And also reflection. I mean, there are a few rooms that I did want to move into because there are so many beautiful books there as well to read.
Yes, so, it's a fascinating place. Yeah.
And you were talking earlier about unearthing, which was such a lovely description. And you do have an exhibition coming up at Brighton CCA called Silt. And that runs to 21st of December?
Yes, it opens on the 22nd of October.
Okay.
So please come to Brighton.
Yes, so that is in Brighton, another part of the UK. And to preempt that, there is a fantastic discussion, which was a little bit over my head, I must admit, but I kept with it, with Sophie J. Williamson. You can access that on Brighton CCA's website. What else is coming up?
There are a few other shows. So right now I've been mainly focused on Silt as it brings together a new body of work for Brighton. And I'm doing a solo show in Moscow after that in affiliation with Garage. And that's going to be an interesting experience.
What's Garage?
It's the big museum in Moscow. And that would be in November. And a few shows here and there, like a show in London and some other projects.
Oh, okay. So we'll list them on the podcast notes, but immediately there is the New Art Centre in Brighton CCA. And on that note, we must say farewell. You're racing off now to organise work for Frieze.
Frieze Editions,
oh,
yes.
Frieze Editions. So you're a very busy woman. And I want to say thank you very much for the book. It did lead to lots of dreaming. So it meant a lot to me, but I feel I haven't finished it in a strange way, even though I've actually read the physical book and I've listened to the audio book.
I think it stays
open-ended. It goes on and on.
Yeah, I think it's very open-ended and there is no specific ending to
it.
You keep passing by it.
Absolutely. Nika Nilova, thank you so much for being on Art Fictions and this wonderful, wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much, Gillian. It meant a lot to be part of it. I'm a big fan of the podcast and I love to have the opportunity to discuss so many things with you, but I feel like this conversation could have gone on another few hours.
Thank you, listeners, and also thanks to the very talented Nika Nilova. The music for this self-produced, abridged podcast was written and performed by Griffin Knipe, while award-winning animator Joanna Quinn of Beryl Productions created the Art Fictions logo. If you'd like to support the series, please subscribe and rate, and you're welcome to get in touch with me directly via my Art Fictions 2020 Instagram or my website, gillianknipe.com. Happy reading and art viewing. Till next time. Do you know much of Rilke's poetry?
I like his poetry, but I do not speak German, so I can only access it in translation, which I think makes it very different. Yeah. Nabokov translated his own books famously because every word carries a certain weight.
Especially,
I think it's interesting because I translate objects and materials and I'm constantly involved in this process of translation. So for me this is interesting, how you appropriate languages.
I just feel we need so many lifetimes to not only read the books but to proceed down different pathways of producing work as well. You could do a whole career of work about language.
Yeah, it is infinite.